Okay, so this is lecture two of Informatics A, 2A. So you remember, I started the first few slides of this lecture at the end of last time, so I'll just quickly recap on those and then get on to the new ones. This is the lecture that gives you an overview of what the course is actually about in terms of its intellectual content. So we already talked a bit last time about what formal and natural languages are. An important concept I'll be introducing today is the concept of the language processing pipeline, which is a fundamental idea that gives a kind of framework for thinking about everything that we're doing in the course. And another important concept we'll be looking at is the concept that there are different sorts of languages. Some languages are, in a precise sense, more complex than others. So there's a kind of hierarchy of language complexity. We're talking about that. I'll then be going over a bit more specifically what will be happening in the formal language half of this course. And then Mirella is going to take over and tell you a bit about what happens in the natural language part. OK, so we noticed that there are various kinds of languages. There are formal languages used in context of computing. There are natural languages used by human beings. And there's also a third kind of thing that when you've got a system like a vending machine that can perform various actions, you can loosely think of the sequences of actions that that thing can legally perform as constituting a kind of language in a general abstract sense. And in this course, we'll be talking about all of those kinds of languages. And the interesting thing is that there's some common theoretical concepts that can be equally well applied to all of them. So we'll be looking at both those underlying theoretical concepts and their applications to the different kinds of languages. As we can see, there'll be some interesting similarities between formal and natural languages and some important differences between them. So one other thing I could mention here that I didn't mention last time is that actually in terms of the history of the subject, there has been some significant mutual interaction between formal and natural language theory. So for example, the linguist Noam Chomsky in the 50s developed the fundamental ideas of context-free grammars, and that's in the context of talking about languages like English. And that is now absolutely standard core material in the study of computer languages. So that's influenced in one direction. And in the other direction, there's old work of the logician Stephen Kleene. This was sort of computer science in the days before computers really existed, but let's call it computer science. It's kind of logic. And those ideas are now equally used both in formal and natural language theory. So there is some interesting commonality here. Okay. Then I mentioned that there's this idea of a syntax tree. So in both formal and natural languages, a phrase or a sentence that you say or write has a kind of structure, a kind of hierarchical structure that you can represent by a tree. So whereas what you explicitly would write in your programming language would be just the surface form of your program, would just be x2 equals minus x1, and there's not any explicit tree structure there in what you write. But there is a sort of implicit tree structure that's going on underneath it, and that's the structure that you need to know in order to do anything useful with the program, like know how to execute it. Same thing in natural language. What you would say would be just the sun shone, but implicitly there's a structure there, and that's the structure that you need to be able to recover if you want to do anything interesting with it. So now let me tell you about language processing pipeline. And this is a version of what it would be for a formal language, in this case, a Java programming language. So this is what I want you to do is to think about what has to happen when you're processing a Java program. So you, the programmer, would start by writing, just typing at the terminal, typing into your editor some kind of source text, and a small snippet of program you might write might be the assignment statement x2 equals minus x1. You'd write a lot of other stuff as well, okay? And then eventually you'll compile your program, you'll debug it, eventually you'll run it. And at the end of the day, you hope you'll get some kind of program behavior. So like you hope your computer will let you play a computer game involving dancing clowns all over the screen or something like that. So there's some behavior, so there's some code that you write, and then there's some behavior that you want to end up with. So what about all the magic that goes on in between? What has to happen in between in order for your program to be rendered as this wonderful program behavior? So let's think about roughly what has to happen. So first of all, and these first few stages are what takes place when you're compiling your program. So first of all, you write just a stream of characters. So first of all, the computer has to somehow chop that up into minimal meaningful units. So it would notice, for example, that x2 belongs together because that's just a single variable name. There's no point in splitting that into an x and a 2 because the x and the 2 don't have any meaning in the context of that program. It's only x2. So whereas you're allowed in Java, you're allowed to write x2 equals minus x1 like that with no spaces between them at all, the computer first of all has to split it up into a stream of what are called lexical tokens, which are the sort of minimal meaningful units of the language. And that process of splitting your input into lexical tokens is known as lexical analysis or lexing. And that's a sort of typically a relatively easy stage, but it has to happen first. Then you've got a program in this form of this stream of tokens. And after that, it has to kind of recover the underlying structure. So it somehow has to get from that to a tree structure like the one we had on this slide here. Okay, so it has to somehow compute or recover what the intended hierarchical structure is. And that was a process known as parsing, and quite a lot of the course will be about that. And the result of the parsing, the output from the parsing process will be a syntax tree like the one drawn on the other slide. Once you've parsed a program, you might want to type check it. For instance, you might want to, the computer will then want to check that the types of the variables x2 and x1 are indeed compatible. So you're not trying to assign an integer to a Boolean variable or something like that. So even after you've got your syntax tree, there's a bit more processing it needs to do, and it might gain some extra information about the types of things or something like that. And then we get to the compiling proper, so having basically digested your input and got it in the nice structured syntax tree, it will then generate some bytecode which will stick in a file of your compiled code, and then that'll be sort of the end of the compilation phase. So if you get that far, your program compiles successfully, you're doing quite well. But of course, you don't want to just compile a program, you want at the end of the day to run it. So once you've got a bunch of bytecode files, when you want to run your program, first of all, the computer will have to link, if your program consists of a lot of different class files, say, then the system will need to link them all, to gather all the ones it needs, link them all together to get something that's runnable in the Javable virtual machine. And then finally, it'll actually run it, and hey-ho, you get your dancing clowns on the screen. Okay, so you can think of this is the process that has to happen. And this is a useful picture to have, because we can point at this picture and say, right, now we're talking about the parsing stage, or we're talking about the type checking stage, or something like that. Okay. So when we're thinking about programming languages, this is we can think of this pipeline as working typically in a very pure way, because at each stage, each of these phases of processing will typically depend only on the output from the previous phase. So for example, after you've done your lexing, you've got a stream of tokens like this, and then you can throw away your original raw source text. You only need to look at that stream of tokens to do the parsing, and then you only need to look at the syntax tree to do the type checking, and so on. So we can think of it as a nice, clean pipeline that works like that. Now, in this course, the kinds of things we'll be covering will be mainly targeted at the earlier parts of this pipeline, the lexing, parsing, and type checking phases. Most especially the parsing phase, which there's quite a lot to say about. And we'll be looking not only at the theoretical concepts, the theory that we need to support this, so for instance, I've drawn these syntax trees up on the slides, but what is a syntax tree? You know, can we give a definition for what the syntax trees for a particular language should be? And more practically, the actual algorithms for doing lexing and parsing and things like that. How do you actually construct a syntax tree? We won't be saying that much in this course about the later stages of the actual code generation or compilation and so on. If you want to learn more about that, there's a good third year course on compiling techniques, which kind of very much builds on what you'll do in this course. However, we will briefly say a little bit about the that relates to the execution or running stage of a program, because we'll touch a little bit on how the intended behavior of a program can be described or specified in a kind of and reasoned about in a kind of mathematical way. So there'll be a little bit on what's called semantics, which is the meaning of programs, what they're actually supposed to do when you run them, that has something to do with the later stages of this process. Okay. Now, very loosely, right? Okay, very broadly, and with lots of ifs and buts, you can think of a similar thing as going on in the case of a natural language like English. So just as when you type a source text into a computer and you do some stuff and it runs, so there's a kind of analogous process that happens when you hear a sentence like this one I'm speaking to you now coming through the air to you in sound waves, okay? Something must be going on in your brain, if you're paying any sort of attention at all, that is. Something must be going on in your brain to process that sentence and to extract some kind of meaning from it, okay? So let's think about what must happen between the raw sound waves which reach your ear and the kind of internal understanding of the meaning or the logical meaning of the sentence that you may or may not end up with. Of course, once you've got to the meaning of a sentence that someone says to you, that might not be the end of the story, because it's then your choice whether or not you let that understanding influence your behavior in any way. But won't say much about that. So you can think of a broadly analogous process of processing the speech input in several stages. So first of all, there's a stage which belongs to the realm of a subject called phonetics. And phonetics is about classifying and describing the sounds that are used in languages from across the world. Okay? So there's a wonderful thing called the International Phonetic Alphabet, which lets you write down speech sounds in a kind of language-independent way with sufficient detail that whatever language it is you're talking about, that's supposed to give you enough information on the meaning. So let's see if I can do this. So Morel will tell me if I get this right. So the English word toucan, for instance, in the International Phonetic Alphabet will be something like this. Is that about right? Thank you. Put a stress mark there. Okay. So this is a phonetic representation of the word toucan that I just said. Okay? And so something in your brain has to be able to identify the sounds that are coming at you and sort of produce something like this from it. Now the second stage is quite interesting. So to demonstrate this, you may not have known this, but the T in the word English word toucan is actually a slightly different sound from the T in the English word starfish. I can demonstrate this. You can do this afterwards. Don't try it now. So I've got a bit of paper here. Right. Now watch this bit of paper when I say toucan. Right? Toucan. Toucan. Nice sort of flap, right? And if I say starfish, it doesn't do that, or it does it much less. Okay? Starfish. Toucan, starfish. Right? You get the idea. Okay? Now that's because in English, when you say toucan, there's a little puff of air that accompanies the T. And you can actually hear it if you listen for it. Right? Okay? And that's written and that's what's indicated in this phonetic alphabet by this little superscript H here. Okay? Now, in English, okay, we have both these sounds, the one with the puff of air, which is called an aspirated T, and the one without, which is unaspirated T. Now, in English, there's no significant difference between those. In other words, it never makes a difference to the meaning whether you say an aspirated or an unaspirated T. And in fact, there's a rule, it's completely predictable in a given context. There's a rule which says if a T is at the beginning of a word or a stressed syllable, then it's an aspirated T, and otherwise it's an unaspirated T, something like that. Okay, so there's no significant distinction in meaning being carried by these two kinds of T's. Okay, so if it's English you want to talk about, then you can simplify down from this phonetic script to something which retains only the sound distinctions that are relevant to English. So there's a sound unit for English which you can just write as T, which can cover both of those things. That's language specific, right? Because there are other languages, I think quite a lot of Indian languages, for instance, when the difference between aspirated and unaspirated T is actually significant. You could actually change a word from one meaning to a completely different meaning just by changing between an aspirated and unaspirated T. So in those languages, you'd have different phonemes. Anyway, you don't really need to know about that, but it's interesting. So you end up, after doing some phonology analysis, with a stream of sound units. There's a sound unit relevant to the language in question. And then you've just still got a sort of continuous stream of sound units, and you want some way to chop these up into words, to know where the word boundaries are. And not only words, but even some words can be chopped up a bit further. So if we have a word like walked, okay, this could actually be chopped up into two little bits, the basic stem of the verb walk, and the suffix, which indicates that it's a past tense verb. Okay, so these, which are the kind of minimal meaningful units of the language, they're things called morphemes. So you want to kind of hopefully recognize the morphemes and what kind they are. Then you might want to go through and build a parse tree again, which is a syntax tree, which is similar to the thing I showed you earlier. Discover the tree structure in a sentence. And there's various other kinds of checking you might want to do. For instance, checking that subjects agree with their verbs and things like that. And then you might well be ready to do a final level of processing to extract some kind of semantics or underlying logical form or meaning from that. And there you're getting onto into the realms of, you know, what is the kind of language of thought, there is such a thing, that your mind is using. And that's a very difficult and deep question. But something like this is going on in both formal and natural languages. So we can see that there's some kind of analogies or similarities between formal and natural languages. But there are also some important differences, right? So look at some differences. So first of all, a formal language can typically be pinned down by a precise definition, right? So in the case of Java, you can actually buy a book, and I have it on my shelf, called the Java Language Specification, okay? And that is the complete and authoritative definition of Java, okay? And anyone who wants to produce an implementation of Java has to kind of conform to what that book says, okay? Natural languages aren't kind of at the outset given to us in any way like that. The definition of, you know, I mean, English isn't defined by some book called The Definition of English. It's just defined by the whole community of people who speak English, and you and different people will probably speak English in slightly different ways. The language is always evolving. There's new words coming in, different grammatical constructions. Also, in natural languages, there's not always a clear distinction between whether a sentence is legal or not. There are sentences that, as it were, just sound a bit odd to some speakers. So there's more of a kind of spectrum between correct and incorrect utterances. So natural languages, it's very difficult to pin them down by a sort of complete and precise definition. So that's a big difference. Another big difference is natural languages are riddled with ambiguity at all kinds of levels. So we'll be looking in the next slide at different ways in which a sentence in natural language can be ambiguous. Normally, this can be avoided in formal languages because you can just design your language and you can legislate. For instance, if we've got an arithmetic expression like this, okay? 3 plus 4 times 5. You might, if you didn't know much about programming languages, think that this might be ambiguous, because do we compute 3 plus 4 and then multiply by 5, or do we compute the 4 times 5 first and then add in the 3? And if you know anything about programming languages, you'll know that the convention in almost all programming languages is that times binds more tightly than plus. So it's simply a legislated fact about the definition of Java that the meaning of 3 plus 4 times 5 is this one rather than the other one. Okay, so there's no real ambiguity in the Java programming language in that sense. In natural languages, we'll see there's ambiguity all over the place. You might think this is a bad thing. It's actually a really good thing, because it means we can tell jokes, right? An awful lot of jokes and humor depends crucially on ambiguity at various levels in natural language. So it's well worth the price that we pay in terms of it being more difficult to process languages, that we can actually use humor. So here's another difference that's closely related to the fact of ambiguity. So I said that in formal languages, the pipeline typically works in a very pure way, which means that the input, each phase only uses the output from the previous phases. In natural languages, it's not like that at all. It's much more that kind of everything's going on all together, and information from later phases can sometimes be fed back to earlier phases. So here's a famous pair of sentences due, I think, to Groucho Marx. Is it? Remember? Yeah. So time flies like an arrow, okay? Whereas fruit flies like a banana, okay? Now, think about the natural ways of understanding those two sentences. In the first one, it's natural to think, to have a reading where we're saying something about time, and what time does is it flies in a certain way. In the second one, flies isn't functioning as a verb, but as a noun, and we're talking about fruit flies, okay? So even the word flies in these two sentences has a different meaning, okay? So it's a verb in the first one and a noun in the second one. And even once we've decided that, you'll see that if you try and think what the structure of these sentences would be, you'd see that the syntax trees for these two sentences would have a different form. So in the second one here, fruit flies is obviously grouped together as a kind of single noun phrase, whereas we don't think about time flies in that way. So what's going on is that information that only really arises right down here about what it is you're most likely to mean when you say these sentences is being used to feed back into earlier stages, even to do with the tagging of words according to which parts of speech they are, and also the way the tree is parsed and things like that. So in natural languages, it's not a smooth, clean pipeline like this. There's an awful lot of feedback going on, a lot of kind of probabilistic stuff going on based on, you know, what you're probably most likely to want to mean. Okay. Here's some different kinds, just to show you that ambiguity happens at all levels, here's some different kinds of ambiguities that can arise in English. So, an ice lolly and an ice lolly, I tried to say them there so that they sounded the same, because if you transcribe them phonetically, they'll see the same, but you can see that where you segment your speech, where you draw the word boundaries, in this case, can make a difference to the meaning. Even after that, you might find that the same word has lots of different meanings, so the word fast can be a noun, a period of abstinence from food, and a verb, and an adjective, an adverb, and it can have several senses between, there are about six different meanings of fast, I think. So there can be ambiguity in the meaning of one specific word. Even once you know what the specific words mean, there can be ambiguities that come from different ways of structuring the same sequence of words. So supposing you saw a headline in a sports magazine that said, complaints about referees multiplying, okay? If you're a normal person, you'll understand this as that complaints are multiplying, and there are more people are complaining about referees than there used to be, okay? But there is another possible interpretation, which is that referees have actually been breeding out on the pitch, okay, and people aren't too happy about this, okay? So that would be complaints about referees multiplying. So depending on whether we draw a tree structure for these sentences which has complaints about referees grouped together, or one that has referees multiplying grouped together, we can get different meanings. Now notice that there's no difference in the meanings of the individual words here. All the individual words here mean the same thing in both cases. Okay, so it's entirely to do with the way it's structured that the difference of meaning comes in. So that's an example of what's called syntactic ambiguity. And then, so even once we've decided on the structure of a sentence, there can still be other ambiguities that come in. So I actually saw a sign at Haymarket Station a couple of months ago, maybe it's still there, which said, in order to help ensure prompt departure of the services, please use all available doors when boarding the train. So I thought, well, I can try it, but I imagine it'll have just the opposite effect. So the ambiguity here comes from the fact that this is actually addressed to a group of people, and the ambiguity is whether it's asking each individual person to use all the doors, or whether it's asking them collectively to use all the doors. So there's loads of ambiguities in natural language, and that radically affects how we have to think about processing stuff. Okay. I've been talking loosely about what might go on in your mind when you're hearing speech, but really what it is we're thinking about in this course is how you might structure an artificial speech processing system. So how you might build a system that can, in some sense, process aspects of natural language. Okay, so that's mainly what we'll be talking about. We won't be saying very much about any claims about what does or doesn't go on in your head. Also, in the case of natural language, you can equally well think of the pipeline as going the other way. So you can think about starting with some meaning in your mind that you want to communicate, and then how do you run the pipeline back upwards to turn that into a speech utterance for something you want to say. That's equally sensible, but we won't be saying that much about it here. I need to speed up a bit. Okay. So, next important point. I'm going to be talking about various kinds of languages, and a crucial theoretical point is that some languages are in some way more complex, more complicated than other languages. And more complicated here can roughly mean that they're harder to describe, harder to specify in some way, also harder to process, harder to compute with. And in fact, it's possible to arrange the kinds of languages that we want to think about in a hierarchy of increasing levels of complexity. And this is a thing called the Chomsky hierarchy. So the simplest kinds of languages that we consider, which are ones that you already met in Informatics 1, are the so-called regular languages. And these are the ones that are sufficiently simple that phrases in them can be recognized just using a finite state machine. So think of a finite state machine as a particularly simple kind of machine. So if a language is simple enough that can be processed by a finite state machine, we call it regular language. There's quite a lot you can do with regular languages, but regular languages by themselves aren't rich enough to account for a lot of what goes on in programming languages, and they're certainly not enough to account for a lot of what goes on in natural languages. So most of this course, or a large part of this course, will really be talking about context-free languages, which are another step up. And this is a level at which we can describe most of the basic structure of programming languages and quite a lot of what goes on in natural languages. You can go a level up from that to another even richer class of languages called context-sensitive languages. And some natural languages do go up to that level of complexity. Or finally, you can go up to all languages that could be described at all mathematically using a mechanical set of rules. So roughly speaking, the structure of this course is that we start at the bottom, which is the top in this list. Okay, we start with regular languages and work our way up the hierarchy into considering increasing levels of language complexity. So there's a picture of the Chomsky hierarchy as a nice Venn diagram. So the regular languages are the most restricted kind of languages, and in theory, every regular language is a context-free language, but context-free languages allow a lot more stuff that you can't do in regular languages, and so on. Okay? we'll be, I'll kind of speed up here. We'll be doing various stuff about regular languages, as on this slide, and various stuff about context-free languages, including a lot about algorithms for parsing context-free languages. And I'll be doing these lectures. And then there'll be a break from my lectures in which Mirella will cover some natural language material, which she'll just about to tell you about. And then towards the end of the course, we'll just pick up our journey through the Chomsky hierarchy again. And I'll say just a little bit about these upper levels of the Chomsky hierarchy. So that's my part. And now it's time for me to hand over to Mirella. So
thank you. Okay, you can hear me, right? Okay, so let's stop a little bit and think. You see that question up there? So forget what you know about languages as speakers of it. If I ask you, what are languages made of? What would you answer me? Don't say pasta, right? What can you think? What makes a language? Yes? Sound, very good. Let's break it down a bit more. There is several languages, as you know. Is sign language a language? Yes, there is no sound, but still it's a language. Is Klingon a language? Yes. Why? Because, of course, it has sound, but also it has units that we combine to actually make things that we recognize as sentences or documents or books or PhD theses or exams or whatnot. So let me see. No? Yes. Okay. So at the basic level, at the bottom of the, you know, hierarchy, if you like, we'll have words. So take a look at this sentence. I made her duck. Could somebody tell me what this means? Yes, there. I made her, exactly, bend her head. And what was the first one? I cooked her a nice meal, right. So my girlfriend likes duck, so I made her duck because she doesn't like, say, beef. So this is meaning number one. I made her duck, it means I made her bend her head. And then there is actually a third meaning, which is the hardest to get, and I had to read the book to get it myself. I'm not a native speaker of English, which is I made her duck. I actually made a duck for her, but it's not the food sense. It's I made her a duck because she doesn't like arts and crafts. In fact, that would be the case for me because I don't know how to do any arts and crafts, so somebody would have to make me a duck out of paper or out of tissue or whatever. So you see, this word here has three meanings, and we'll learn how to actually get these meanings. So what contributes to these meanings is that some words have different classes. So we'll learn a lot about these classes, which we call parts of speech. So I is a different class than made, which is a different class from her, and so on and so forth. And I'm not going to go into the details, but one important thing to notice is here that duck has two classes. It's either a verb, duck, I bend my head, or a noun, the bird, or the food, or you know, the arts and crafts thing. And on the upper level here, you see that we have three trees. And the three trees represent the three representations. So our ultimate goal is to get a tree that tells us how the sentence is structured. And you learn a lot about trees in this class. I apologize. Actually, most of my bit is about how you get those trees. But actually, that's not what's really cool about what we're going to do. The really cool thing is how we can get the computer to do it. So the second part that we'll address here is, can we actually do all these things that I said to you automatically? Can we get a computer to understand that I made her duck has three meanings? And can we get the computer to actually get these interpretations? And by the way, do people have a feel of what is the most likely interpretation of I made her duck?
The dish one.
Yes, exactly. It's the dish. I made her duck. I made her the the food rather than I made her bend the head. So as native speakers, we have actual intuitions about these things, and we want the computer to get to take advantage of this. Right, so to preface whatever we'll say, the computer can do all of these tasks that humans do, and some of them actually very well. So we will learn how to recognize the basic classes of words. These are the parts of speech. Then we will learn how to do parsing, and we will introduce a lot of algorithms. Some work better than others. And then we will study the meaning of words. And we'll do a lot of sentences that have to do with men loving women, and in particular things like every man loves a woman. How many men are there, and how many women does a man love? If I say every man loves a woman, it could be one woman, the unique woman of his life, or very many women, if he likes a lot of women, or it could be serially, or whatever. And we want the computer to actually compute this interpretation. And as John was saying, we will discuss the links between formal and natural languages and where they differ, where they're similar. Okay, now, the third part of the course has to do with programming. And you won't be explicitly taught Python, although we do expect you to actually pick it up as we go along. And the first assignment, which is on my staff, is almost all exclusively on Python. So can I see how many people have heard of Python before? Wow. Have you used it? Who has used it? Oh my God, we have to make the assignment harder. Okay, good. Excellent. kidding. Okay, so, part one is how to we actually break down languages in different parts and study the theory of it. Part two of the course will go about, you know, how we do it automatically. And part three is Python and how we actually get the computer to understand language using a programming language. This man there is the inventor of Python. He's now working in Google. He's rather rich. And his name, he's Dutch, Guido van Rossum. And I tried to find out what Python means other than the snake, because if you get the book, you will get the snake. Apparently, Python has some meaning, but I failed to find it. You guys may be better at finding it. I looked for 10 minutes, and Google wouldn't tell me what Python is. Several people have asked the same question as me, but there's no answer. Okay, it's an interpreted object-oriented programming language. And it incorporates several, it has some nice features. You can do modules, you can do exceptions, you can do dynamic typing. It has classes, dynamic data types. It's a bit slow, they don't tell you that. But okay, for my purposes, if you do the kind of research that I do, it's kind of slow. But it has nice interfaces to many other languages like C and C++. Now we won't use Python as such. We will use Python with NLTK. NLTK stands for Natural Language Toolkit. It was developed by Stephen Bird, Ewan Klein, who is a professor at this university, and Edward Lauper. And the book is online, so you don't need to buy the book, but you do need to bookmark the URL. And if you feel very eager, start going through this. You will start doing this anyway from week three in your lab session. So we start slow, but then it picks up. Okay. Right. So now the last bit I like to motivate the whole course will be on applications. So after you have done your informatics 2A, you will have a pretty good understanding as to how some applications work that have to do with natural language, if you are practically minded. So for example, you will have some ideas to how to do summarization. And you'll be surprised to know that it's not really rocket science. So let me ask you, how would you get a computer to summarize an article? So we have two kinds here. We have a single document that we summarize, or multiple documents. On the top of your head, come up with an algorithm that actually summarizes text. It doesn't have to be correct. Just anything. Yes?
Number of occurrences of particular words.
That's an algorithm. Okay, right. Okay. His algorithm is the following. You count the words, and then you sort of present to the user the sentences that have the most frequent words or the least frequent words. Correct. So we need to have some notion of what things are important and not important, and a good heuristic is to do it with frequency. Okay, some other algorithm. Yes?
Skipping function words.
You can skip function words. and present to the user the document without the function words. Do people know what function words are? Okay, function words are things like and, the, or, if, so, which don't carry much meaning. So one algorithm suggested here, and it would summarize something, it would be to just drop the function words. And so have something like name, George, Bush, came, weekend, sick. You could get some meaning. Okay, but you guys haven't come up, yes?
What about take the words that are the biggest in the screen or the titles and stuff like that and use those?
Okay, now this is good. This is good. And in fact, people do it. Google does this. This is a good point. So you see the snippets that Google gives you? This is their idea of summarization. I actually asked them, I said to them, why do you guys do this? The snippets are meaningless. They said, no, they're very meaningful because we actually get, so this is a very good point. You just get the titles and the subsection titles, and this is your summary. But of course, in order to do that, you need to identify the sentences, and you need to know what the word boundaries are. And we'll know how to do this in this course. Here's what people do. You can get 25% of the beginning of the document. This will get you far if you're summarizing news articles. Because in news, there is a convention that all the important stuff is said in the beginning. You could extract sentences, you could extract phrases, words. You guys came up with this. But the most important thing is how we select. And we can do things like at random, which wouldn't be great, the beginning of the document, or the salient units, which is the suggestion we had with the frequency of words. And now I will give you another application, which is super duper cool. And I would say half of the work nowadays in natural language processing is done on machine translation, which is something very useful. We can understand it. So the goal here is to translate text from one language into another automatically. So from English to French and vice versa, or whatever language you like. Now, this is a very difficult problem. It's actually an NP-hard problem. There is a proof that shows that machine translation, in the formal sense, is NP-hard. People have been working on this since the 50s. And the revolution that they came up with is something called the noisy channel model. And this is an idea that people take from encryption. And I'll talk you through it. So the idea is that we have a noisy channel. We have a source, our English. The English goes into the channel, and then something happens. It gets corrupted. And the English gets corrupted and comes out as French. Okay? Now, the computer has to take the French and think, aha, it's a code for English. It's a cipher. So I will actually decipher it. So we will reverse this process, and from the French, then, we will go to English. Now, you'd think this is idiotic. Does it really work? I mean, translators, you know things about the world and about life, and they spend like 6 years at university, and how do you think that a computer can do this? And I have news for you, my friends. The computer does do it. Using many concepts that we've talked, that we will be talking about, I mean, in the past, yes, that we will talk about in this course, such as parsing, such as part of speech tagging, and so on. Like I'm saying here, many of the algorithms we'll learn in this course will be used in machine translation. Google has got onto this, and of course Google wants to do everything. So if you try, they have a machine translation engine online, and some of the language pairs they're doing are not too bad. In fact, sometimes I get like Chinese students send me these email messages, and they're very nice, but they forget that I don't speak any Chinese. So they're all written in Chinese, but it doesn't matter, because thanks to Google, I can actually understand what they say. So it's very useful. All right. Now, next, we'll summarize, and then I'll take questions. So, INF2A, we've covered what it's about. Hopefully by now you have a clear idea. Like I said, we will learn about formal and natural languages. We will discuss similarities and differences. Well, John said this, I didn't. We will cover concepts like finite state machines, context-free grammars, syntax trees, part of speech tagging, and ambiguity. Ambiguity will be chasing us all over the place. We will use Python for natural language processing, and hopefully you will find this course interesting. Now, next lecture is a proper lecture, so we actually start covering the material that exists in the course. It's on finite state machines, and it should be a revision to you all. If it's not a revision, come to the lecture. In any case, you should come to the lecture. If you want to do some reading, here are the chapters. And before I let you go, do you have any questions for me or John? And have you picked up your clickers?
Yes.
You picked up the clickers. Good. Okay. Any questions? All right. Good.
Next lecture. Not entirely revision. I will sneak in.
Oh, sorry. It's not revision, so it's new stuff. Okay. All right.
Let's see, we have to, that was good.
You do escape.
Yeah.
All right, and then?
And then you can just close that.
And that.
And that. And then, you do an eject from whichever one of these says.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, set them, great. Okay, right. You can remove them.
I can remove them. And then,
then
we have to log out. So I would log in.
We see if we're
Yeah, I forgot that last time. That's all right.
Great.
Okay, good. Well done.
So, dear John, we'll communicate, but I'm not coming in. I'm afraid.
Oh, no. Please don't.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.